He burned his own studio to the ground and claimed it was possessed. He spoke in riddles, wore mirrors on his hat, and walked barefoot into recording sessions like a prophet. But what if the man they called crazy was actually decades ahead of everyone else? Lee Scratch. Perry didn't just invent dub music. He ripped apart the very foundations of sound itself and rebuilt them in his own psychedelic image. Long before remix culture or trap beats existed, Perry was layering echo, delay, and distortion into sonic hallucinations that reshaped global music forever. And yet, the music industry barely knew what to do with him. Why was his influence buried under the legends he helped create? From Bob Marley to The Clash? Was it his madness they feared, or his power to change music history? Perry's story isn't just about innovation. It's about erasure, cultural theft, and a genius too raw for the system to control. So, if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favourite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. The Alchemist of Sound. The Jamaican sun beat down on Kendal, a rural farming village nestled in the heart of Hanover Parish. Roosters crowed, goats bleated from roadside bushes, and barefoot children chased the dust trails of trucks heading toward Montego Bay. In the midst of this simplicity, a young boy named Rainford Hugh Perry was busy smashing rocks in a riverbed, not out of rage or boredom, but because he believed he could hear messages in the sound. "I was building rhythm before I knew it had a name," he once said. Born on March 20th, 1936, Perry didn't grow up around orchestras or sheet music. His family was poor, scraping together meals from the land and stretching coins to buy school uniforms. But from an early age, Perry saw, or heard, something no one else did. He believed the universe spoke in sound. Not just melody or beat, but vibration, energy, prophecy. It was the first crack in the doorway to a musical revolution no one yet understood. By the time he left school at 15, Perry had already rejected the strict colonial framework imposed on young Jamaicans. The British educational system, imported and rigid, didn't. Does it say about us that we couldn't recognize a genius until he was gone? Because Perry wasn't just a man. He was a mirror, showing us what it looks like to create without apology, to live without limits, to destroy what no longer serves and rebuild in fire. So maybe the next time you hear an echo bounce off a track, the next time a bass line feels like it's alive, the next time an artist breaks the rules, you'll remember the man who made rules irrelevant. You'll remember the mad scientist, the sound alchemist, the prophet in rubber boots and mirror hats. You'll remember Lee Scratch Perry. Know what to do with a boy who wouldn't stop humming in class or talking to stones. Rainford drifted. He laboured on construction sites, trained as a welder, hauled rocks, until he realised rhythm lived in everything, even in the metallic clang of a jackhammer. So, in the late 1950s, Perry left the hills for Kingston, the capital city that was quickly becoming the musical heart of the Caribbean. The post-independence surge had brought new energy to the island's cultural scene. Sound systems, makeshift street parties powered by huge speaker boxes and vinyl records, were pulsing across Kingston's ghettos, offering escape, identity, and raw community. It was here that Perry found his tribe. He began working at Coxone Dodd's legendary Studio One, the so-called Motown of Jamaica. Starting as a record scout and errand boy, Perry quickly impressed with his ear for talent and his wild, unapologetic ideas. He helped shape early ska and rocksteady hits, and even recorded some of his own music under the nickname Little or Scratch, which referred to a chicken scratch dance move popular at the time. But despite his contributions, Perry's relationship with Dodd soured. He was brilliant, but he couldn't be controlled, a former Studio One engineer recalled. Scratch would come in with five different rhythms in his head and try to mix them into one song. Coxone wanted order. Scratch wanted alchemy. Tired of being dismissed, underpaid and censored, Perry left Studio One and bounced between rival studios like Joe Gibbs's Amalgamated Records. Each move ended in conflict, mostly because Perry refused to follow rules. He layered animal sounds into tracks. He sang lyrics backwards. He flooded vocals with echo and buried bass lines beneath waves of static. He even claimed to record certain songs with no human hands involved. "Music isn't just what you hear," he once said. "It's what you feel in your blood." By 1973, Perry had had enough of compromise. Using the little money he'd saved and help from friends and believers, he built his own studio in Washington Gardens, Kingston. He called it the Black Ark, a name steeped in biblical weight and spiritual promise. Unlike the slick, state-of-the-art studios in the US or UK, the Black Ark was a modest, almost primitive, setup. Its walls were padded with foam and cardboard egg trays. Its equipment was battered. A Teak four-track recorder, a Roland Space Echo, and a mixing board patched together with wire, spit, and mysticism. Perry decorated the walls with symbols, drawings, Bible verses, and ancestral faces. He burned incense constantly and claimed to trap evil spirits in jars of urine he stored on the floor. But within this bizarre creative temple, Perry created magic. From 1974 to 1979, the Black Ark produced some of the most haunting, revolutionary reggae and dub tracks ever recorded. Perry's signature was unmistakable. Reverb-heavy vocals, ghostly horns, swirling echoes, and deep pulsing bass lines that seemed to reach through time itself. He began recording albums with Max Romeo, War Ina Babylon, Junior Mervin, Police and Thieves, and the Congos, Heart of the Congos. Works so emotionally rich and sonically layered, they baffled engineers abroad. The music was often political, steeped in Rastafarianism and Jamaican mysticism, with Perry acting as both prophet and producer. And then came the Wailers. Bob Marley, Peter Tosh, and Bunny Wailer had already become stars in their own right. But it was Lee Scratch Perry who sharpened their edge and channeled their fury. The earliest Wailers sessions at Black Ark, Soul Rebel, Small Axe, Duppy Conqueror, weren't just hits. They were war cries, laced with fire and defiance, crafted with the touch of a man who saw sound as revolution. "He didn't record songs," said one visitor to Black Ark. "He summoned spirits." But for all his genius, Perry remained outside the mainstream. Jamaican record executives often saw him as a liability. Foreign producers were eager to capitalize on his innovations, but not to pay him fairly. As reggae went global, many of Perry's sounds were stolen, stripped down, and marketed under other names. The mainstream loved the myth of Perry, the madman, the eccentric wizard. But few recognized him as the inventor of dub, the man who redefined remixing before DJs even had a name for it. Dub, that haunting, spacious, hypnotic manipulation of rhythm and echo, was Perry's language of resistance. It stripped songs down to their spiritual essence and rebuilt them into something ancestral, something prophetic, and it was Perry who first understood what that meant. As the Black Ark became a spiritual hub for Rastas, artists and outcasts, Perry began recording not just music, but ritual. He kept no schedule. Musicians might be summoned at 3 a.m., required to fast, or banned from using profanity. He claimed he could hear invisible vibrations in the room. He said the studio spoke to him in tongues. To some, he was losing touch with reality. To others, he had found a new one. But here's the question no one asks. What if Lee Scratch Perry wasn't mad at all, but simply saw the world through frequencies the rest of us were too deaf to detect. Why was his sound adopted by white punk bands in London and Berlin, while he was pushed out of the very industry he built in Kingston? And how did a man with no formal training, no fancy tools, and no major label contracts become the blueprint for every modern producer from Dr. Dre to Kanye West? As Perry stood at the helm of his mixing board, surrounded by smoke and sacred symbols, the world was beginning to listen, but still not understand. He wasn't just making music. He was altering reality. Chapter 2. The Fire Inside the Ark. There's a moment, just before fire touches wood, when everything is silent. The breath of the match, the heartbeat of something about to change. On a quiet day in 1979, that moment arrived for Lee, Scratch, Perry, and the Black Ark. It wasn't an accident. He meant to set it all on fire. But the reasons why remained tangled in myth, madness, and prophecy. By the late 1970s, Perry's name was whispered with reverence across global undergrounds. In Kingston, he was the eccentric sonic priest. In London, he was the reggae architect who birthed the raw power behind punk. In Tokyo and Berlin, dub disciples studied his tape loops like scripture. The Black Ark had become the epicenter of a sonic revolution. But inside Perry's mind, chaos was brewing. The studio walls were changing, covered in graffiti, sacred symbols, and words scrawled in mirror writing. Mirrors hung from the ceilings to reflect negative spirits. Plastic bags of herbs, candles, chicken feathers, and urine appeared in corners. Perry began pacing the compound barefoot, talking to himself, preaching to shadows, scribbling mystical messages on equipment with chalk. People started asking, had Perry lost his mind? The real question was more complicated. Was Perry losing himself, or protecting his soul from a world trying to take it? The music industry was circling. Record labels, foreign producers, and even Jamaican collaborators were trying to siphon Perry's sound, without credit, without royalties. Bob Marley had moved on to Island Records, and Chris Blackwell, who now polished Perry's raw brilliance into global hits. Perry's name faded from liner notes. His production style became the bedrock of reggae's international sound, but few outside Jamaica knew who to thank. He didn't trust anyone. The Black Ark, once a sanctuary, began to feel like a trap. Sessions became erratic. Perry would erase vocal tracks mid-recording. He'd flood songs with distortion. One time, he walked into the studio and declared no recording would happen until everyone danced for the spirits. Another time, he allegedly locked a singer out for wearing synthetic clothes, claiming the fabric disrupted the frequencies. Behind it all was paranoia, or purpose. Perry believed the Black Ark had been spiritually corrupted, infiltrated by greed, false idols, and demonic energy. He claimed certain musicians were using the studio for the wrong reasons, trying to steal its power. Some visitors later admitted they were trying to copy his techniques, even film his process without permission. One day, he walked through the compound with a hammer, smashing tapes, consoles, speakers, then lit a match and walked away. The Black Ark burned, and with it, dozens of unreleased master tapes, original mixes, forgotten rhythms, experimental dubs no one would ever hear again. To the outside world, it looked like a breakdown. But to Perry, it was a cleansing. Fire, after all, is a form of rebirth. In Rasta cosmology and biblical prophecy alike, fire purifies. He later said the Ark was possessed and needed to be destroyed. So who betrayed him? Some say it was the producers who exploited him. Others say the musicians who mimicked his sound but erased his name. Some even whisper that it was Marley himself, the protege who outgrew the prophet. But maybe the true betrayal came from an industry that embraced Perry's product, but not his personhood. They wanted his echo, not his truth. And Perry knew it. The aftermath was devastating. Perry drifted through Kingston, often alone, barefoot, wearing capes and goggles. He scrawled messages on sidewalks. He sang to birds. Some said he was crazy. Others said he was mourning a death no one else could see. The death of sound as spirit. The reggae industry moved on. Dancehall was rising. Digital rhythms, drum machines, and slick production replaced analog mysticism. The soul of the Black Ark, warm, raw, imperfect, didn't fit the new formula. But even as his homeland turned away, Perry's cult status abroad exploded. In London, the punk movement was embracing dub. Bands like The Clash and Public Image Limited cited Perry as a primary influence. He began collaborating with a new generation, from British experimentalists to German noise producers. Perry's sound, warped, layered, unpredictable, now felt more at home in post-punk clubs than Kingston dance halls. But he never went mainstream. He couldn't, because Perry didn't just make music, he made meaning. And meaning wasn't for sale. In exile, Perry became even more mythic. He moved to the Swiss Alps with his wife, Mireille. There, surrounded by snow and silence, he painted walls with prophetic symbols and recorded strange, brilliant tracks in his basement. He wore costumes made of feathers, rubber snakes, and tin foil. He claimed to be a space alien, a time traveller, a vessel for divine sound. But beneath the antics, the message never changed. Music is sacred. Sound is power. And Perry still had more to say. One collaborator recalled. He didn't care about takes or tuning. He cared about vibration. If the spirit wasn't there, he'd scrap the whole track. He'd walk out in the middle of a session and say, "No soul today. Come back when your heart is awake." Let's pause and ask the hard questions. Was Lee Scratch Perry driven mad by his own genius, or by a world that didn't know how to honour it? Why do we celebrate the pioneers after we've stolen their fire? What would music sound like today if Perry hadn't burned the Black Ark? Or did that fire set something bigger in motion? Dub didn't die in the ashes. It scattered. The ghosts of Perry's rhythms found their way into hip-hop. Electronic, ambient, trap, experimental jazz. Kanye West, Flying Lotus, Massive Attack, and countless producers have borrowed the techniques he pioneered with nothing but tape loops and instinct. But they didn't invent it. He did. And yet Perry never tried to reclaim his place at the centre. He remained on the outskirts, watching his sound mutate across generations. Occasionally, he'd speak in riddles, laughing at how they still didn't understand what he was doing. "They copy my echo, but not my energy," he once said. "That's why they cannot create, only imitate." The fire didn't end his story, it rewrote it. It turned Lee Scratch Perry into a living ghost, a burnt prophet walking through music's halls of fame without a plaque. He was both legend and exile, revered but rarely understood, sampled but never credited properly. He didn't need their awards, because he already knew the truth. He built the ark, he flooded the world, and when the industry tried to chain him, he lit the match. Chapter 3. Exile, Prophecy and Resurrection. It wasn't supposed to end like that, not for the man who'd split sound open like a prophet decoding thunder. But after the fire, Lee Scratch Perry vanished from the place he'd helped define. And then, he reappeared where no one expected. The Swiss Alps. Imagine it, the godfather of dub. The barefoot mystic of Kingston, living in a tiny village nestled between pristine mountains and snow-blanketed roofs. The man who once summoned bass lines with incense and chalk, now wore ski jackets and recorded in a chalet. It sounded absurd. It was absurd. But then again, So was Perry's entire life. He wasn't hiding, he was transforming. His wife, Mireille, a Swiss businesswoman and artist, grounded him while nurturing his eccentricity. Together, they created a space that mirrored the Black Ark's chaotic energy, but in a quieter, colder environment. Perry covered the walls in wild paintings. He scribbled messages to God on the ceiling. He spoke of alien communication through frequencies and said the Alps helped clear his spirit. But he never stopped making music. From this strange European exile, Perry began a new chapter, one filled with unexpected collaborations, fierce independence, and defiant clarity. The Resurrections begin. Perry's early collaborations abroad were with underground visionaries, British post-punks, German avant-garde composers, Japanese sound artists. These weren't top-charting names, but they understood what he was doing. They gave him space, they let him be weird, and in return, he gave them transcendence. He worked with the Mad Professor in London, creating a series of dub albums that felt like transmissions from another planet. He paired with Adrian Sherwood's On You sound for politically charged, bass-heavy experiments. Even The Orb, pioneers of ambient house, tapped Perry's voice and vision for their futuristic tracks. His fingerprints were suddenly everywhere. Techno clubs in Berlin, dubstep circles in London, experimental scenes in Tokyo. Still, he was never mainstream, and he never wanted to be. Because Perry wasn't chasing charts, he was chasing truth through sound. He once told a French reporter, "Music is not music, it is prayer, it is science, it is revenge." The Grammy no one saw coming. 2003, Lee Scratch Perry won the Grammy for Best Reggae Album with Jamaican E.T. It was surreal. The man the industry ignored, mocked, or feared, now honoured on its biggest stage. He didn't change for it. He didn't thank the Academy. He thanked Jah. That same year, he declared in an interview, "I was sent here to destroy evil with sound." That wasn't metaphor. Perry believed he had a spiritual mission, and that dub was his weapon. He remained prolific into his 70s and 80s. He collaborated with younger artists across genres, rock, rap, EDM, dubstep. But no matter how modern the beat, his essence was unchanged. His voice was always layered in echo, his words cryptic sermons, his presence electric. In 2010, Rolling Stone listed him among the 100 greatest artists of all time. But for Perry, that kind of validation meant little. He'd already been erased once. He knew the game. The industry couldn't box him. Perry's career never followed a predictable arc. That's what scared people. They wanted the story of Marley, the rise, the struggle, the global breakthrough, the sainthood. Perry didn't give them that. Instead, he gave them chaos, prophecy, fire, laughter, madness, soundscapes that defied categorization. They called him mad. But who decided what sanity was? In a system that chewed up black genius and spit it out sanitized. They called him difficult, but maybe he was just unwilling to sell the parts of himself the industry demanded. They called him forgotten. But everywhere you listen, you hear his ghost. The final years, still untamed. In his final years, Perry became something more than an artist. He became a living monument to what the industry feared, uncontrolled creativity. He toured the world into his 80s, performing barefoot, wearing capes, spraying cologne into the crowd, tossing out riddles between songs. Fans came not just for music, but for the ritual. Every show felt like a séance. Even in interviews, he refused to play along. He spoke in metaphors, he shifted between characters. He called himself a fish, a lion, a UFO, and always a prophet. His home in Switzerland was part studio, part art installation, part temple. He built shrines to fire, water, wind, and echo. He filmed bizarre but beautiful music videos in his garden, wearing gold crowns and staring straight into the sun. And yet, amid the madness, his message remained razor sharp. The industry is broken. Sound is sacred. Creativity must be free. August 29th, 2021. The prophet falls silent. When Perry died in Lucia, Jamaica, at the age of 85, it felt like a drumbeat had stopped mid-measure. For many, it was the end of an era. But for those who understood him, truly listened to him, it was clear. The echoes weren't stopping. They were just beginning to ripple outward. Legacy. Not just a producer. Let's strip it all back. The props, the mirrors, the fire. What remains? A man who invented dub, changing the way we think about remixing, sound engineering, and rhythm. Mentored Bob Marley, producing the earliest Wailers recordings that defined global reggae. Built one of the most mythologized studios in music history, the Black Ark. Transformed limitations, four-track mixers, analog tape, into innovation decades ahead of its time. Lived defiantly, creatively, and spiritually, on his own terms, till the end. But here's what we're still not asking. Why was Lee Scratch Perry not a household name, while others built their careers off his sound? Why do we worship the polished products of creativity, but exile the raw creators? And what,